So I just want to get things started. My name is Adele Perry, and I teach in the history department at the neighboring institution of the University of Manitoba. And we'll just begin by acknowledging we're here on Treaty 1 territory, the territories of the Anishinaabe and Cree people, the homeland of the Métis Nation, and we drink water from Treaty 3. I'm really pleased to see such a good turnout in what is an awkward time of the academic year, where we don't often have opportunities to hear our colleagues or academic visitors. But when I saw the notice from the Black Canadian Studies Association that Professor Barrington Walker was coming to keynote at Black Canadian Studies Association, which is meeting in Brandon starting tomorrow, I thought this is a possible opportunity and that we can perhaps join in on and see if Barrington could also take a bit of a stop in Winnipeg and speak to us. And we were lucky that he was generous enough and able to do so, and that the two history departments at the two universities in town were able to get together and make that work. So I want to thank both those history departments and also the Faculty of Arts at the University of Manitoba for making it work. But most of all, I want to thank Professor Walker for being willing to add a few days to his busy itinerary and come and speak to us. So Barrington Walker is an associate professor of history at the Department of History. That was awkward. At Queen's University. And his work at CORE seeks to illuminate the contours of Canadian modernity through exploring Canada as a racial project, through histories of white supremacy, slavery, colonization, immigration, segregation, and Jim Crow. And he looks particular at how these practices were sometimes challenged, but more often reinforced by practices of law. Barrington is the author of Race on Trial, Black Defendants in Ontario's Criminal Courts from 2010, and also of two edited collections, The African Canadian Legal Odyssey and The History of Immigration and Racism in Canada. And for people that are interested in complicated histories of slavery in Canada, I would recommend in particular the introduction to The African Canadian Legal Odyssey, which has a very substantial and I think really important chapter in it. Professor Walker is currently working on two new books. The first is Colonizing Nation, A History of Race and Immigration. And the second is Dark Peril, Blacks and the Social Order in North America's Urban Landscape. Professor Walker's work, I think, is critical, taken kind of as a corpus in a number of respects. One, it's an enormous teaching resource for those of us that teach Canadian history. And some of you have read Professor Walker's works with me in Canadian history classes. But what I also want to just sort of say briefly here is how critical Barrington's work has been for, I think, thinking through Canada's history as a project that has interlocking structures of race and dispossession at its core. And through his sort of very detailed and meticulous and thoughtful work, Professor Walker really provides readers with ways of rethinking Canadian history in really significant and important ways. So today, Professor Walker is going to be speaking from one of those works in progress that I mentioned. The title is Dark Peril, Blacks and the Social Order in North America's Urban Landscape and the Case of Dancing. And so I will turn things over to Professor Walker.
Thank you, all of you, for coming. I know that this is, as Adele said, kind of a quirky time in the academic calendar, so I'm appreciative that you took time away from. This is a time when we all venture off and re-engage in our own research project, so I'm grateful that you came. And I'd also like to give a real heartfelt thanks to James and Adele for extending the invitations. My first trip to Manitoba. I was telling Adele that all I know of Manitoba is hockey and the CFL, right? So there's a couple of landmarks I have in my mind. But other than that, it was a real treat to get a sense of the city last night. So what I want to talk about today is, it was interesting, at dinner last night, I was asked a question about what exactly are you doing? And sometimes it's those questions that help you to clarify in your own mind what exactly it is you're doing. So I'd made this decision this morning that little bits and pieces of things that I'm going to be working on I think are going to coalesce into a larger project that talks about the larger question that interests me, and that's the phenomenology of Black violence and anti-Black violence in recent histories of North America, right? And trying to map out where all that is coming from, sort of the underlying forces behind that. So the title of my talk today is Dark Peril, Blacks in the Social Order in North America's Urban Landscapes, and I'm going to be looking in particularly at the case of Danzig, the shooting that occurred in Toronto. I hope you'll indulge me, I'm going to be reading most of this presentation. I don't normally do that anymore, but because there are ideas that I'm trying to carefully work out, I hope you'll indulge me reading significant portions of the paper. So on July 24th, can everybody hear me at the back? Good. 2012, the Toronto Star published a cartoon in the wake of the infamous Danzig shooting in Toronto, which took place on July 16th, 2012. The incident, which occurred again on Danzig Street in a low-income or geared-to-income public housing development during a block party and barbecue, has been dubbed the worst shooting in the history of the city. It was widely considered to be an especially brazen crime, even in a city where gun crimes were allegedly becoming increasingly common. The shooting claimed 25 victims, 22 of whom had been injured by bullets, and two were killed. Cartoonist Michael Diatter drew a cartoon that featured a young Black girl in a formal dress and braids, as you can see on the slide here. Her innocent gaze is fixed upon the viewer, her hands behind her back. The title of the cartoon is Injuries to Expect Before They Are Too. Drawn around the little Black girl are three arrows pointing to various parts of her body. An arrow pointing to her right elbow has the caption, "A boo-boo from a high chair." An arrow pointing to her left foot indicates that she bears the scar of, quote, a mark from a tricycle. And a third arrow, the artist's punchline, points to the child's head. And it says, quote, "Head laceration from a medium caliber bullet." The insensitivity, the callous regard for young Black lives that this cartoon expressed scarcely needs comment. Indeed, in the face of public protest, the Toronto Star and its cartoonist were forced to issue an apology. Right, and I might add one of these sort of, not quite, I'm sorry if you are offended, but not as genuine an apology as I would have liked to have seen. But what interests me more than the impolitic nature of the cartoon is the constellation of attitudes and the cultural context that informed it. Before they issued their apology, of course, the editors at the Star had made the decision to run it. Right? So somebody made the decision to run this cartoon in the first place. In addition, the humor that underlines the piece tapped into deep-seated loathing and fear of urban Black communities, those communities that stood outside the bounds of the Toronto Star's imagined community of literate, urbane, middle class, and progressively and politically progressive readers, rather. So the young Black girl's body, her head lacerated by a bullet, or a head that was about to become lacerated by a bullet, was more than just a punchline. It showed how the intelligibility of Black bodies depended upon their being constituted in and through violence. So this chapter, or this talk, this paper, will examine the Danzig shooting and argues that it can be held up as an example how these communities are imagined and dominant, and again, even in allegedly liberal and progressive conversations about lower-class Black life in Canada. These communities are imagined as in but not part of the city and the nation. Recall the headline again, Injuries to Expect Before They Are Too, emphasis mine. I don't think it's splitting hairs to point out that Adder did not use the words our children in his title because he did not see his imagined little Black girl as part of his we, his community, his city, or his nation. The chapter argues further that the little girl conjured by Adder's imagination, like the Black denizens of the other Toronto, existed in one of the many, quote, zones of exception and I'm sure you have similar sorts of communities here in Winnipeg, that are apart from the rest of the city spatially and biopolitically. The violence that permeates these communities is said to be a product of a culturally defective and impoverished communities, the members of which are inherently prone to violence. The cartoon reinforced the notion that the cultural norms of the Black community were pathological, and this has been a long conversation in North American history, far outside the bounds of normal civilized and civil society, a menacing yet laughable subculture where a bullet wound to a child's head was not some aberration, but a rite of passage. The body of the little girl was a waste body, disposable and insignificant. This was a body that only counted in the aggregate, crime statistics, or if dissected and itemized, could map a culture of poverty and barbarity. So the next section, I want to go on and talk about some of the theoretical interventions that I'm thinking about with this case. So located, and some of the spatial interventions as well. So located just to the west of Morningside Avenue, Donzig Street is located in the former Toronto suburb of Scarborough, now part of the Amalgamated City, in a historic section of Toronto called West Hill, right? An area that, quote, was sprawling farmland before it was rebuilt as a suburban enclave in the last century. It's a cluster of So on Donzig Street, there exists a cluster of Toronto community housing units, geared to income housing units, that would be tagged with the shorthand Donzig in the press coverage. Here one finds six rows of townhouses built in 1969. And the socioeconomic and demographic profile of the neighborhood, based on 2011 census figures, is telling, right? So the data incorporates the entire neighborhood of West Hill rather than just the street in Donzig. And I have to dig a little bit deeper in the data to see if I can get a capture a picture of exactly the profile of the residents of the Donzig street. But in terms of the larger picture, what we find is that there are 26,000 people, so it's a very densely populated neighborhood, living in mainly family-occupied homes. Just over half were Canadian-born, and the rest hailed from immigrant source countries, Jamaica, Guyana, the Philippines, and Sri Lanka. We also find in this community that the unemployment rate was slightly higher than the Canadian average, sitting around 13%, so quite high. And the average family income in this neighborhood as well was, unsurprisingly, considerably lower than the Canadian average of $52,000 in 2011. The family average was about $46,000. So these figures were no doubt troubling in some regards, but at the same time flattering, in the sense that they illuminate as much as they obscure, because the community surrounding Danzig would have invariably pulled these figures up, right? So I suspect that the data actually is much worse if you dig down to the townhouse complex. Nonetheless, it is clear that Danzig is one of those communities that is stubbornly resistant to liberal and anti-race rather than anti-racist narratives of multiculturalism. Perhaps the city of Toronto's most cherished self-perception, I would say self-delusion, and deeply desired global brand. So this shooting was, according to one newspaper, the event through which Danzig, quote, entered the Toronto lexicon in a burst of bullets. Thus, through the shooting, Danzig entered into the pantheon of other dangerous and marked communities in Canada, and the Jane and Finch community was preeminent among these. Many of you must be familiar with the Jane and Finch community. Sociologist Carl James has written extensively about what he calls at-risk communities in Canada. His important work, his foundational work, Life at the Intersection, is a study of the Jane and Finch community in northwest Toronto, a neighborhood that has long been stigmatized. Citing social theorist Loïc Wacquant, James at length theorizes the place of the stigmatized neighborhood, what he, drawing on Wacquant, calls lawless zones. And Wacquant goes on to say, quote, to outsiders and insiders alike, the lawless zones, the problem estates, the no-go areas, or the wild districts of the city territories of depredation and dereliction, to be feared, fled from, and shunned. Such is their reputation. But in these matters, perception contributes powerfully to fascinating reality. Hotbeds of violence, vice, and social dissolution, owning to the halo of danger and dread that enshrouds them, and to the scorn that afflicts their inhabitants. A variegated mix of dispossessed households, dishonored minorities, and disenfranchised immigrants. They are typically depicted from above and afar as somber and monochrome, in monochrome tones. And social life in them appears to be somewhat the same, barren, chaotic, and brutish. Now, I am somewhat ambivalent about the way that Laquant characterizes some of these communities, because I think in some ways it ties into or it sort of speaks to some of the pathological constructions of poor inner city communities that were dominant during the 1960s. And our American historians in the room know this history quite well, what was going on during that time. But I do find his characterization of these sorts of hyper-marginalized communities useful and important. And I argue his characterization is much more fundamental. Or I argue that in his characterization is the much more fundamental notion that denizens of such communities have an attenuated connection to humanity. Indeed, for me, the barren, chaotic, and brutish depictions of their lives have strong resonances with Achille Mbembe's writings of the West depictions of Africa and what he calls the post-colony. So while Mbembe's post-colony is located in Africa, of course, his work is of value for thinking about how the community that I'm studying here, how its recent past and the dominant perceptions of the people who inhabit this community. Mbembe argues for the violence that frames a colonial condition, right? What he calls a phenomenology of violence, right? He introduces this concept in chapter 5 of his seminal text on the post-colony when he writes, "In this chapter, I shall reflect on that state of deprivation or apparent non-actuality called death. By focusing on the violence of death, I want to look at the forms through which it is accomplished, the manner in which it embraces all substantiality, indeed to the point where it has penetrated almost everywhere and virtually nothing escapes it, since to a large extent it has become the normal state of things." So for me, this concept of the phenomenology of violence is a useful way of thinking about the relationship between violence and humanness, whose bodies are valued and whose aren't. And again, by pointing this out, I don't mean to absolve those who've committed these murders of personal responsibility, nor do I want to make the mistake of obliterating the reality that many of these folks who live in these communities make lives and how they do and can affirm life in these communities. But the reality is, I think, that violence saturates these communities and limits the life chances of those who live in such places. I think also that Mbembe's work, one of the things that he goes on in his, there's a long quote here that I won't read, the other one, but he goes on to subsequently talk about what he calls life inside the pure terror of the negative, right? The fact that it's marked by premature death, what he calls a death without meaning. And he goes on to talk about the blurry, almost barely distinguishable lines separating homicide, genocide, and suicide in these communities. He also rather provocatively asks us to ponder what relationship human beings, right, or those who are deemed as human, should have with those who have been placed outside the category of humanness. So coming back to the case of Danzig, the Toronto Star newspaper offered extensive coverage of this trial. And on November 2nd, 2012, the paper ran an article titled "Danzig Shooting, A Timeline of the Aftermath," replete with a detailed map to help its readers spatially and temporally track and trace the aftermath of the city's worst shooting. That's the map. I'm not sure if you all can see it from the back, but I will walk you through portions of it. I promise I won't be too detailed about it. But in general, what this article did was it walked its readers through the timeline and a corresponding map, starting with number 5 and ending up with number 6. Right? So it begins by talking about the party that took place, right? The neighborhood where the party took place.
So that was down here in Danzig. So you can see how sprawling this map is, right? So it starts by talking about the shooting that took place here.
Then it moves to talk about a couple of shootings that happened subsequently. Here in number 2 is at Shepherd and Finch Avenue, and number 3. So you can see the wide sort of geographical zone that's covered by this map. The article goes on then to talk about a couple of arrests that were made, a couple of other of these young people who were shot, who were associated with the Danzig shooting, right? Folks who are quote-unquote known to police and known to have been in the neighborhood during that time. I won't go through all the details that I've written here, but I think the most important points for me about this, the fact that the way in which the Toronto Star tried to make this shooting intelligible to its readers was to make connections between the Danzig shooting and subsequent shootings that were really quite tenuous in my mind, right? So what interests me in that article is the narrative of Black criminality and the spatial and cultural narrative of Black criminality that's fleshed out in that map. And the first shooting that they map out, of course, is July 16th with the Danzig shooting. And this timeline goes all the way to September the 20th, right? So again, both in terms of geography and in terms of some of the links that this article is trying to make between some of these shootings, it's interesting to hear what you all have to say about it or what you think about it, but it's quite clear to me what sort of narrative was being fleshed out here and the kind of picture that the paper was attempting to paint about Black criminality during this time. Okay, so the next section I want to talk a little bit, I call it nation time. I want to talk a little bit about constructions of nationhood, right? So we've talked about a little bit about the immediate kind of spatial conversations that took place. But there's also an important conversation that takes place around nation in this case as well. So as I stated before, the scope of the Danzig shooting was what made it spectacular, but at the same time, it was also decidedly unspectacular. Though gun crimes in low-income and predominantly non-white areas did not go unnoticed nor unreported, as they do in many U.S. cities, by 2012, Torontonians had by and large come to associate gun violence and lawlessness with certain zones of the city, as I've said before. Thus, the Danzig shooting was remarkable only because of its body count, I would argue. In terms of the sorts of bodies that were felled in the hail of gunfire that rained down upon the city, the shooting was decidedly unspectacular. While it raised alarm, it did not incite precisely the sort of moral panic as did earlier shootings in the commercially, culturally, and socioeconomically central Young Dundas areas of the city. Danzig was a different matter. As mentioned before, the bodies that inhabited its rows of public townhousing was in but not of the city. So while the discourses surrounding the shooting was decidedly about racially mapping a city, it was also, unsurprisingly, about nationhood as well. And I was talking about some of this at dinner last night. And not only was the neighborhood a zone of exception, but it was also an interior frontier that marked the borders of the nation. Almost inevitably, in a now well-worn racial script, of nation-making, elite white politicians swooped in to turn this shooting into a matter of national importance. So, for example, Jason Kenney, you're all familiar with, who was then the Canadian Federal Minister of Justice, tweeted this in response to the shooting. "I agree with / Mayor Ford. Foreign gangsters should be deported without delay. That's why we've introduced Faster Removal of Foreign Criminals Act." The reference to the shooters on Danzig Street as foreign gangsters was no coincidence, right? The image of the dangerous foreigner has been a staple of Canadian nativist discourse dating back to the turn of the century. And Kenny's statement is evocative of dominant fears of Bolshevism and communist sympathies amongst members of the working class. While Eastern European workers are the penchant for radical politics, alongside a host of other non-British and non-white groups, were groups that pose a threat to the project of British-Canadian nation-building at the turn of the century. 100 years later, little had changed for blacks who were still considered dangerous outsiders. The Danzig shooting thus came to sit squarely at the center of a conversation that was decidedly characterized by what social theorists call discursive slippage, a discussion that was about the shooting and the pathologies of the people who perpetrated such crimes quickly and inevitably, I would argue. Well, historians aren't supposed to talk about inevitability, but it seems like that's where these conversations invariably go. Also became a discussion about immigration and crimigration, right, and the crimogenic citizen. Toronto Mayor Rob Ford and then Prime Minister Stephen Harper also used the shooting to make the case for their popular policies, a law and order agenda. Even in the context of a city where the violent crime rate had been going down for decades. So the commingling of discourses of crime and immigration in the city of Toronto and Canada were not new, right? So in 1993, for example, Toronto was thrown into the grips of a moral panic in the wake of a botched robbery-turned-shooting at Just Desserts, an upscale dessert restaurant. The perpetrators were three black men of Jamaican extraction, and their victim, Vivi Lemonis, was a young, ethnically white woman of Greek descent. Politicians at all levels of government took notice of the shooting and rushed to assuage the fears of the city's population that law and order concerns were a top priority amongst the city's elected officials. Indeed, by 2002, in response to the moral panic engendered by the shooting, the Canadian government passed Bill C-44, otherwise known as the Just Desserts Bill. Discourses of nationhood permeated the case in other ways. While white politicians blamed the shootings on foreign gangsters, others tried to understand how such an American-style crime could have been visited upon Toronto the good. Two things point to the angst that was generated by the Danzig shooting in Canadian culture. There was a CBC television special expose on the shooting, and Drake and I'm not going to rap or sing or anything, but a Drake and Snoop Dogg, Snoop Lion, I'll get to that in a second, song called No Guns Allowed. So a year after the shooting, in 2013, in July, CBC television aired an expose on Danzig. The CBC had gone into the neighborhood to see if, quote, anything had really changed in the year after the shooting took place. Now, the piece was featured on the network's flagship evening news program, The National, and it was a retrospective, melodramatic rendering of the shooting and an attempt to demystify this horrific crime, again, an American-style level of violence that seemed out of step with Canadian values and Canadian culture. The piece began with CBC reporter Paul Hunter conducting an interview with Eugene Jones Jr., the then president of the Toronto Community Housing Corporation. So Jones had been lured away from a similar role in Detroit. He was heralded as, quote, the executive director who turned around the Detroit Housing Commission, end of quote. He was in the midst of an administrative shuffle wherein Detroit's Housing Commission left the auspices of the federal government's Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, into an independent organization. So he won all kinds of accolades and awards for overseeing the Housing Choice Voucher Plan, redevelopment, and other programs. So Jones and his willingness to stray from liberal political orthodoxy and embrace a voucher plan as a solution to Detroit's public housing crisis was thus the ideal choice for Toronto and Toronto's conservative mayor, Rob Ford. Ford was a son of Doug Ford Sr., a man who was from a hard-scrabble working-class background and made the family fortune in founding the Deco Labels and Tags Company, a company that had its manufacturing plants in Etobicoke, one of Toronto's, when he founded the company, not so much anymore, working-class inner suburbs. Ford rose to power on a crest of populist sentiment fueled by the resentment of large segments of the white working class and a large group of racialized immigrants from the outer boroughs of the amalgamated super city region of Toronto. Ford blended his folksy appeal to the city's non-elites with a tough-on-crime rhetoric that resonated with many of the city's citizens, most notably those who lived in some of the areas that are typically associated with high crime rates and gang activity. Ford's populist appeal was also a product of his ideas about the real politic of city governance. While he was, as mentioned above, he was moored in the precepts of the political right, governance for Ford was not performed in council chambers, his office, he was rarely in his office, or in high-level meetings, but in tending to the everyday needs of his constituency, the Ford Nation, as they were dubbed in the press. Rob Ford was notorious for personally answering the phone calls of his constituents when he was a city councilor, a habit that he maintained when he took on the much greater responsibilities of the mayor's office. Mayor Ford was notoriously often witnessed being chauffeured in his large black SUV on his way to answering a call from one of his constituents who had reported a pothole in need of repair, a leaky roof, or a cockroach infestation at one of the city's oft-neglected public housing units. As part of his vast appeal, Ford was also a mayor who engaged in what I call a symbolic rhetoric and practice that appealed to superficial notions of racial inclusion. Ford, an avid football fan, was a coach of a successful inner-city football program during much of his time as mayor, which would get him in hot water because he was coaching these kids when he should have been attending to city business. Ford prided himself on his perception that many of his players were disadvantaged youth from impoverished, matrifocal, black single-parent households. Ford fancied himself a beneficent father figure to these youth, boys who would otherwise likely become high school dropouts, thus beginning their inevitable slide into criminal activity. But Ford's rhetoric was contradictory, even hypocritical, in two ways. Probably more than two, but I'm going to talk about two ways. First, beneath the mayor's tough-on-crime persona was a history of personal struggle with alcohol abuse and crack use, evidence of which surfaced in an undercover cell phone video that was broadcast widely online and on network television, and his association with some of the more unsavory criminal elements in the city. Second, while Ford had a skill for connecting with non-white constituents, much to my irritation, but it was true, on one particular instance, a drunkenly profanity-laced monologue in tortured Jamaican patois that was captured on video and seemed to endear him to many members of the community. He also pursued a neoliberal agenda of governance that hurt very much these very same communities. The impact of Rob Ford's lean and mean government ethos was disproportionately borne by some of his most vulnerable and adoring constituents. He slashed community supports, once derisively referring to after-school initiatives that targeted inner-city youth as, quote, hug-a-thug programs. So one of the pivotal moments in this program was archival footage of a CBC reporter and an interview with Paul Hunter, who asked Jones, the American expatriate from one of the most economically devastated and high-crime chocolate cities, to assess the gravity of what occurred in Danzig and how this affected his view of his job. And in one of the pivotal moments of the interview, the voiceover says, "When the shooting happened a year ago, Jones had been on the job running Toronto social housing neighborhoods. Just 3 weeks, suddenly confronted with a mass shooting here and a city on edge." Jones goes on to say, "It doesn't happen like that in the United States. You don't get 23 people being shot in social housing." So that was a shocker. The interviewer, Paul Hunter, says, "Even by American standards?" And Jones says, "Even by American standards." So that was very, very, very shocking. Later in the interview, Jones told Paul Hunter that a year later he no longer wore a flak jacket when he went on night patrol. So Jones was so spooked by the shooting that he had taken to doing his night patrols in a bulletproof vest. He goes on to say that he no longer wore the jacket, crediting his decision to an epiphany that he had after the shooting. So he said, quote, "I just go out now. I just go out there now. I just go out. I took the vest off. I thought it was appropriate at the time. I guess I had an epiphany about it when in Detroit. In Detroit, you better wear a flak jacket. Here, you don't. That sends the wrong message," and so forth. No doubt reaffirming the border in this way must have assuaged the fears, at least momentarily, of CBC's viewing audience on that evening. But others were not so sure that the border could be drawn that safely or sharply. The second way in which the story of the shooting at Danzig Street was taken up in national discourse, and this is a point I will develop further as my research progresses, was through hip-hop music. The story of hip-hop in North America is long and complex, Don't have time to go into it now. And the subject of a richly developed body of scholarship. Rinaldo Walcott's seminal work, Black Like Who, dealt extensively with how Canada's first generation of hip-hop artists sonically made, unmade, and transcended the nation-state through the diasporic identifications that are distilled in and expressed through the hip-hop tradition. Similarly, newer scholar Francesco D'Amico, a brilliant PhD student at York University, argues, quote, by drawing from local and translocal imaginings, Black Canadian rappers created counter-narratives intended to question notions of Canadian citizenship, multiculturalism, and the normalized narrative of, quote, white, unquote, Canada. While engaging in these oppositional politics, rappers have consistently encountered exclusionary practices at the hands of the state in an order to render blackness hyper-invisible while simultaneously including and purging it from the national memory. In the wake of the shooting, Drake and U.S. rapper Snoop Dogg, who at that time was trying his hand at, very badly I might add, at the reggae iteration of his career, so he called himself Snoop Lion for a year or two, and he came to his senses and went back to calling himself Snoop Dogg. But he collaborated with Drake on a song that was largely inspired by the events at Danzig, titled No Guns Allowed. They did a single, and they also did an accompanying video. And the song was certainly a collaboration of the sort that signified Drake's status as an international celebrity, one who transcended the status of his Canadian hip-hop predecessors. So there's that going on. This was a part of an entertainment project and a way for Drake to signal what a big star he was by doing something with Snoop Dogg. So that I don't dispute that. But nonetheless, I don't think it's a stretch to suggest that this collaboration was indeed also a profoundly political statement on the part of an artist that is, in the main, his body of work is quite apolitical, right? He's best known for his iconic status as a bankable international brand. His ability to transcend borders when he focused on the plight of Danzig was also readily up to the task of shining a light on the translocality of the phenomenology of violence in North America and the marginality of its Black communities. In so doing, the border dissolved, as did the romantic myth of multiculturalism. So in conclusion, the Danzig shooting was a terrible incident, an incident that held the city's rapt attention. While other previous high-profile murders in the city, such as the shooting of Jane Priba or the Just Desert shooting before that, garnered attention because of where they took place and to whom, Danzig was a little different. Of course, the usual hue and cry from the usual suspects sought to tie the shooting to immigration, right? The alchemy of crimmigration, the process through which domestic local crimes become tied to national immigration policy. The Danzig murder lacked the moral panic about race and place that emerged when innocent whites were murdered in places where shootings were not supposed to take place. The Danzig shootings took place in the right neighborhood for this sort of thing, and by and large it happened to those whom one would expect, the usual suspects. But the sheer scope of the shooting and the level of violence that it entailed shook even seasoned law enforcement officials. Conservatives fulminated that the gangs were out of control, that the jails needed to be fuller and the deportations of these lawless thugs needed to be ramped up. The liberal press, meanwhile, tended to focus on stories of Danzig's redemption and the perseverance of community members who struggled to carry on in the face of the tragedy. But more than this, the liberal press fretted about the persistence of communities such as Danzig that seemed impervious to the benefits of Canadian state multiculturalism and the cultural diversity that was at the heart of Toronto's long-emerging post-war identity. Thank you.